even though I knew her words just might upend my life like a table, sending everything crashing so that I'd have to start over. Or maybe not even though. Maybe because. With the state I was in, I couldn't say for sure. She went on, gathering steam. Maybe this moment is the test. I have been watching you because I'm old, and that's what I do. Sit outside of things and watch. I see that you're a good person. A loving daughter. A true friend. What if it's time to be your own friend, Claire? If your grown-up self took you by the hand right now, where would she lead you? No one should live with someone who scares her. My heart began to pound, but I sat up as straight as I could. Could you hold my hand again? Just for a minute, before I go? Courage, dear heart, said Edith, and she held. I deserved to remember his face until the day I died. I don't mean his face after, but the way it looked before, when I knocked on his hotel room door and he said, come in, and I did. His face in the tiny, shiny, hope-lit spot of time before I started talking. The trust, the instant openness, like something blooming, and the joy. I shut the door and leaned against it.
Hey,
he said, grinning, turning off the TV and standing up. He still wore his golf clothes, a pink and white striped polo shirt and frog green shorts.
You're totally breaking the rules, you know.
I held up my hand to stop him from walking toward me and forced myself to keep looking at him. Zack, I need to say something.
Anything.
I am sorrier than I have ever been in my life and than I ever expect to be again, even if I live to be 100. But I can't marry you. He opened his mouth, but no sound came out. Like I'd thrown something heavy at him, he rocked back on his heels and fell into his chair.
Give me a sec.
He placed his hands on top of his head, fingers drumming, and shut his eyes. When he opened them, he said,
I get it.
You do? Heaven help me, I felt relief at the possibility that I'd be let off the hook so easily, even though no one had ever deserved it less.
You need more time, and come on, of course you can have it.
The relief flipped over and died.
Honestly, I've been worried that I rushed you. I almost said something the other day, but I chickened out, which was wrong of me,
said Zack.
And screw all this, the big wedding, our families, bad idea. My family alone is too much. What was I thinking?
Don't, I said, my eyes filling with tears. Don't take the blame.
We should have run away. But now here's the thing, to hell with them all. We'll wait and do it alone, just the two of us, whenever you're ready, on a moment's notice even.
He ran a hand through his hair, excitedly.
How could I not have seen that just the two of us would have been so much better? The whole point of getting married is to be just the two of us, making a new family on our own terms. Forget the rest of them.
No, it's not them. It's us. It's me. I love so many things about you.
Well, I like the sound of that,
he said with a shaky smile. I shook my head. But I can't spend my life with you. I can't envision it at all, and I promise you I've tried.
But I can fix that. I can change, and you'll change too. That's what happens in a marriage. You adapt to each other.
Zack, please listen to me, I said. I never feel completely like myself when we're together. I can never quite relax. I've always known this deep down, but I wouldn't admit it. You're a good guy, and I wanted to make you happy, but we aren't home to each other.
I'm a good guy?
Zack winced and slapped a hand to his stomach as if he'd been punched. Oh, that came out wrong. You're decent and kind. You try so hard to always do the right thing. That's what I meant.
You're home to me. You are, I swear.
But, I said, you aren't to me. You're a lot of wonderful things, but you're not home. He opened his hands, and with a sweet, almost childlike certainty, he said,
I can be.
Very, very gently, I said. No, you can't.
What? You mean ever?
Ever. I'm sure of it. I'm so sorry. He seemed to consider this, and then shook his head.
You don't mean it. You'll change your mind.
No.
It might take time, but once the dust has settled from all this big wedding bullshit, you'll change your mind.
Please don't. Zack cut me off.
Claire, just go now. No wedding right now, I get it. It's fine. But we'll talk soon. I'll be patient. I'll do anything to fix this, which is how I know it's going to be okay. Plus, I love you.
Without a word, feeling every inch a monster, I left.
Chapter 7. Edith. June 1951. Joseph became a photographer for the local paper, one that served not only the string of beach towns, but the entire southern portion of the state. Before he offered him the job, the editor, Beau Flieger, cigar-chomping, fast-talking, big-hearted, all of 5'4", warned Joseph that it'd be pretty damned tame stuff after what he'd been doing in Europe, but Edith knew that her husband would delight in it. Holiday parades, high school football games, fireworks, society weddings, as much as there was a society, political rallies, ribbon cuttings, even the occasional funeral or petty crime, trespassing, break-ins, public drunkenness, a gas station attendant robbed at gunpoint. It was what Joseph had missed most during the war, all the small, scattered pieces of the precious and luminous ordinary, evidence that life insists on continuing. Then, on a summer afternoon, 1 week shy of Edith and Joseph's first anniversary, the driver twins, Robbie and Susie, 12 years old, were out in their dinghy checking their crab pots when a storm hit. Except for its sudden and unexpected arrival, bruise-colored clouds materializing along the tree line to the east, then a rush of wind spilling them like ink across the sky, the storm was unremarkable. No hail, no flash floods, no miles of downed power lines. Wild, tree-snapping winds, some stomps of thunder, spatters of lightning. A typical summer squall, short-lived as a tantrum, certainly not the kind of weather event that kills people. Except that the driver twins never came home, a fact their parents discovered only when they returned from work, hours after the storm had fled the scene, blowing out as spasmodically as it had blown in. John Blanchard, the town's chief of police, hastily put out a call for a search party. And half the town showed up, men, women, teenagers. Known for his cool head, blonde hair, and perpetual air of calm, John was Joseph's friend. The two men ran into each other at crime scenes and town events, and occasionally, John called when he needed photos for a police file. In the case of the search party, he left the role Joseph would play ambiguous, saying only, "Better bring your camera." "To photograph the happy driver family reunion," said Joseph. "Hell, I hope so," replied John. Because she couldn't bear to be home by the phone, at loose ends, swinging between hope and dread, Edith tugged on a pair of blue jeans and the knee-high rubber boots Joseph had given her for Christmas and went along. Some of the searchers set out in boats. Others combed the woods edging the salt marshes, hoping the kids had put ashore and taken shelter amid the trees. Just before dark, the driver's neighbor, 80-year-old Roger Payne, found the boat, overturned, empty as a husk, and floating farther out in the deep waters of the bay than anyone had dared imagine. Most people went home after that, disheartened, promising to come back at daybreak, hungry less for their dinners than for the lamp-lit rooms and solid floors of their houses, the living faces of their own children. They wanted to watch fireflies hover and flicker above the cut grass of their lawns, to pull tricycles into the safety of backyard sheds. A few kept searching, including Edith, Joseph, and John in John's skiff. They navigated the maze of channels and inlets and ponds, kept close to the water's edge, raking flashlight beams through the marsh grass and brush, disturbing sleepy birds, black ducks, clapper rails, and willets, and once a blue heron, breath-stoppingly huge, that broke from a clutch of shrubs and, after one prehistoric cackle, winged silken and liquid-necked, noiseless as a paper airplane, low across the water and into the night. They found them just as the sun slipped above the horizon to simmer in the tall grass and beam pink against the white sides of the houses far to the west. Robbie at the mouth of an inlet, snagged in the talon-like roots of the pine trees that gripped the shore's edge and hung out raggedly over the water. And Susie, not 25 yards away, lying face down in a plot of thick-set, feathery, plumed phragmite weeds. They were both fully dressed, except for their shoes. Even Susie's hair had stayed braided. Once the three of them were ashore, John Blanchard took off his glasses and rubbed his eyes.
We'll need to photograph them, Joseph.
Just for our records, not the newspaper.
God knows, no one wants or needs to see this.
Joseph just nodded. But in the morning light, he looked not merely sad but haunted. His eyes hollow, his mouth trembling. When he raised the camera, his hands were shaking, so without a word, Edith took the camera from him, wiped the tears from her face, and stepped into the tea-colored water, stirring up tempests of silt with her boots. As she photographed first Robbie, then Susie, she tried to put her emotions away, to focus only on the act of taking accurate pictures, but in the end, whatever it took to turn a dead child into any other two-dimensional scrap of light and shadow, she didn't have it. The details pierced her. The exposed strip of pale skin on Robbie's leg where his shorts rode up, the straight line of Susie's carefully parted hair. Edith moved around the children, catching them from a variety of angles. By the end, she heaved with dry-eyed, audible, chest-burning sobs that didn't stop. Not when John and Joseph lifted the twins into the boat, not when she covered each with the blankets they'd brought to warm them, if only they had found them alive. But later, at home, she did stop, and it was Joseph who cracked, shivering and weeping and saying, "Oh God, oh God, oh God." Edith understood that it wasn't just the deaths of these children that were shaking him to the core, but also all the deaths from before, during the war. She built a fire, even though it was summer, wrapped her husband in quilts, rocked him in her arms, and wove a cocoon of words, descriptions of every loveliness that crossed her mind, birds and mosses and flowering plants, the sound of a creek rattling through woods, a cluster of cabbage butterflies fluttering, dance-like, on a patch of ground. She gave him morning coming through their bedroom windows and the shapes of leaves. She gave him the names of things. Because the pain of losing the children hung on hard, Edith would do it for weeks, this whispered comforting. And each time she would lie awake long after he'd fallen asleep, enfolded in two sorrows, Joseph's and her own, but also in a radiant, awestruck gratitude at what she understood was the great honor of her life, not being loved but loving, soothing this good man, making him feel safe.
Chapter 8. Claire. Even though I didn't have much time to develop expectations in the numb 3 hours between those two conversations, the first with Edith and the subsequent one with Zach, I had expected relief. Maybe not over and above other emotions, but I had expected to walk out of Zach's room and be aware of it, running silvery through my psyche beneath the guilt, like an artesian spring. Honestly, I'd expected to have to hide it, to keep every trace of it off my face for Zach's and decorum's sake. And I'd expected hiding it to be hard. But the relief didn't come. Not as I was walking away from Zach's room, not when I walked into my own to find my wedding dress, camellia cool and eyeing me from its padded satin hanger, not when I went into the bathroom and splashed my hot cheeks and then downed the complimentary bottle of fancy water, culled straight from an actual artesian spring in actual Fiji, gulping frantically and loudly, like a person who'd been lost in the desert for a week. Not even when I witnessed the same sort of relief I'd expected for myself illuminate sunburst style the faces of my mother and Cornelia. Instead, I felt purely horrible. And I don't mean I felt miserable, although I did. I mean, I felt that I was horrible, transfigured into something heavy and misshapen, mean and core rotten and cruel, coated so thickly in horribleness it was like I'd been rolling in it. I had been mad at myself before. I had been disappointed in myself. But I had never, until the moment I called off my wedding to Zack, been repulsed by myself. In one 10-minute conversation, I had wiped my name off the list of kind and decent people. By the time I got to the door of Cornelia's room, I had begun to believe, to know, that I'd never been on that list in the first place. All those years I'd spent thinking I was a good person. Once, a long time ago, Teo had told me I was a good person, made of good materials.
"Just being you is being good,"
he'd said, and I'd believed him. When I had really been hopelessly bad all along. If I'd expected to fling open the door and announce my news, and I think I had expected that, the flinging part definitely, by the time I actually stood outside it, I could barely bring myself to knock. I listened to my mom's and Cornelia's voices, and I knew that they were getting the kids ready for the wedding. I knew that my mother said, "Just a few more, Rose. Gosh, you're being so patient and staying so still," because she was curling Rose's hair. I knew from Cornelia's singing High Hopes, cheerfully but with a note of exasperation and interspersed with commentary like, "Would you look at that perfect loop? I've never seen a more perfect loop in all my life," that she was trying to inspire Simon to tie his own shoes, a task he loathed. Typical goofy family stuff. But as I stood outside that door, steeped in my own horribleness, it all struck me as astoundingly beautiful. "You don't even deserve to overhear this," I told myself, much less to go in and be part of it. But I had to go in. There was music to be faced, a wedding to be dismantled. Oh God, the wasted money alone made me feel like a criminal. And anyway, deserving or not, even in the smack dab, ugly middle of my self-loathing, I wanted them, my mother and almost mother. I wanted just to be near them. No flinging open the door for me, though. Just barely more than a brush of knuckles against the frame. Cornelia called out, "Dev, if that's you, get in here and take this shoeless wolf boy of a child off my hands!" I opened the door. "It's not Dev." Everyone, even Simon the wolf boy, went still, staring at me. "I'm not marrying Zack," I said bleakly. "It's over." That's when the relief broke like morning across their faces. After one quick glance at each other, they shook it off, composed their features into looks of concern, but I'd seen it. And still, I felt only wretched. "Oh, honey," said my mother. "What happened? Can you tell us?"
"It's just that no one should live with someone who scares her."
I blurted it out, but as soon as I had, I hated myself. If I'd sat for hours calculating what explanation would garner me the most sympathy and support from these two particular women, I would have made a beeline for that one. The words sounded overblown, underhanded, manipulative, painting me as the victim when I was the monster. The fact that the words were also true just didn't matter.
"Oh, God," said Cornelia, standing up from her chair. "No," I said. "It wasn't like that. He never hurt me. I just mean..."
I tipped sideways and leaned against the wall.
"Kids," said Cornelia, clapping her hands. "Run down to your brother's room. Tell him to take you out on the lawn for, oh, anything. What's your favorite game?"
"Croquet," said Rose. "But in my dress?"
She fanned open her rose-sprigged skirt with her two hands, and love for her squeezed my heart like rubber bands. I would have given anything to go with her, to be a 9-year-old girl in a dress heading out into the sunshine to play croquet.
"No worries, darling," said Cornelia, smiling. "Tell Dev I said you need to play outside. No shoes necessary."
And in a rush of pastels, clean hair, and gorgeousness, they were gone. My mother and Cornelia turned to me, waiting.
"Okay," I said, holding up my hand like a traffic cop. "But you are not allowed to comfort me. I am a terrible, careless, destructive person for letting things get this far."
"But," said my mother,
"promise. No reassuring words, not even a hug."
"You drive a hard bargain," said Cornelia,
narrowing her eyes.
"Promise."
They sighed and nodded. With as little editorializing and emotional display as possible, I recounted my conversation with Edith.
"She helped you. Maybe she saved you,"
said my mother quietly. A total stranger. Don't, I snapped. I see where you're going, and no one is allowed to feel guilty or take responsibility for my mistakes. They're horrendous and all mine.
We had misgivings, said Cornelia sadly. All along.
But you trusted me, I said, because I've always been pretty trustworthy. Just not this time.
You know,
said Cornelia, pointing Simon's shoe at me.
And I'm really not comforting you here, or letting you off the hook, or whatever it is you don't want me to do, but you know that however terrible you think what you did was, doing the thing you didn't do would have been much, much worse. Unforgivably worse.
Yes, I said grimly. I do know that. Go home, sweetheart, said my mother. Leave everything to us. I shook my head.
I won't be gotten out of anything anymore, thanks.
It was a quote from Cornelia's favorite movie. She smiled, but shook her head.
The power of the Philadelphia story is nearly limitless, but nope, not this time, she said. You must let us do this. We command you.
You're not the only one who feels guilty here. I started to protest, but she cut me off with a hand slash to her throat.
You don't get to tell us how to feel, my girl, said Cornelia. We watched you around him, always on tenterhooks, constantly poised to jump in and smooth things over. We should have intervened, helped. At least let us help you now.
I can't just leave you to deal with the fallout,
Cornelia said wryly. If it makes you feel any better, there's bound to be plenty more fallout later.
You can deal with that.
Go pack, said my mother, pointing to the door. Everything but your wedding dress. Then, go home, although you are certainly not getting behind the wheel of a car.
But I want to be alone.
This wasn't true. Being loathsome and cruel, I was actually the very last person I wanted to be alone with, but I didn't want other people either. What I would have most preferred was to be put in a medically induced coma for at least a week, possibly a year.
Sorry, said my mother. Not on those winding country roads, not with those shaking hands.
They aren't shaking.
I glared at my hands, the little traitors, clenched them to try to stop the trembling, then gave up in disgust.
We'll ask Dev to drive you back, said my mother.
Not Dev, I said quickly.
She glanced up at me, startled.
Because it might hurt Zack, I said.
Such a sweet and considerate girl, so thoughtful of Zack's feelings, so protective. God, I made myself want to throw up. Hildy and Aiden drove me home, and even though the two of them were among my very favorite people to both talk and listen to, I couldn't do either. In the back seat, I hunched my shoulders, pulled my cardigan around me like a straitjacket, and tried to think about nothing at all, while outside the car windows, twilight dwindled, turning the Blue Ridge gray. At 4:22 a.m., at home in my childhood bed, I woke up panicked. Sure in my bones that I'd made a terrible mistake. Zack was right when he'd said marriage meant adapting. Everyone knew that. I should have stood by my word, zipped on my stupidly expensive white dress, and marched down the aisle straight into my beautiful future. Panting, sweating, with my heart stuttering and my sheets twisted around me like a boa constrictor, I swore to myself that it wasn't too late. I would call him, beg him to take me back. I would fix everything. My scrambling hands groped my bedside table for my phone and yanked out the charger. On the illuminated screen was a text message from Dev that he had sent after I'd fallen asleep.
If this is totally inappropriate and exactly what you don't need, delete immediately.
The message accompanied a photo of him and Teo shoving handfuls of wedding cake into their mouths, the pocked and dilapidated cake listing in the background. I didn't laugh, but I almost did. Came closer than I ever thought I could, leaning back into my pillow and smiling ear to ear into the dark like an idiot. And not only because the photo was funny, but also because of what had always been true. Even when I wasn't with him, just knowing that Dev existed in the world made me happy. Okay, no, that hadn't always been true. Almost always, but there was a year in there. My last year of high school. When it hadn't been true at all. Not by a long shot. When we were a couple, Dev and I didn't live in the same town and would go as long as 2 months without seeing each other. And there were moments when I missed his physical proximity acutely, and in very specific ways. His arm against mine,
the slightest whisper of skin on skin as we lay on our backs on a blanket, staring at the night sky. Or his head in my lap as we watch TV, the blue light resting on the side of his face. But while there were tough days, the missing never hurt that much because we texted constantly, emailed, and talked into the night, and I could always see an endpoint not far away. A date on my calendar, circled with a heart and marked D-Day. And then Dev went to Africa. Africa. Not Spain or France or Oxford, England, or New York, or any other place I'd ever heard of a person spending his gap year. Dev signed on for 9 months in South Africa doing HIV/AIDS education and assisting in a rural medical clinic, with an additional 3 months at an orphanage tacked on for good measure. South Africa, and not even Cape Town, but a village so tiny and remote that his phone would be useless. When he told me he wanted to do it, my whole body went cold, but I gave him my support. Who could argue against helping people who are sick and poor? Who could align herself against orphans? Also, the gap year wasn't just for these people. It was for me. Dev had skipped 8th grade, so that even though we were the same age, he'd graduated from high school a year ahead of me. But our plan had always been to start college together. He deferred his acceptance to the University of Virginia, where I would apply early, and where, as a resident of the state and a crackerjack student besides, I was sure to get in. The 1 year apart meant we'd spend the 4 following, and all the years after that, together. I held up nobly, everybody said so, until Dev's graduation party, a week before his flight to South Africa, when I stood in Cornelia and Teo's pretty, bloom-riddled backyard, watching Dev laughing at something Cornelia's brother Toby had said, his head tilted forward, his eyes dancing, and felt the bottom fall out of my world. I didn't settle for just breaking down. No, I exploded like a pipe bomb, barely making it into the house before the jagged pieces went flying. Sobbing hysteria, flailing, unintelligible ranting. When my mother put her arms around me, I threw them off and ran blindly upstairs and into the nearest bedroom, which happened to be Dev's. Confronted with his books, his computer, his sneakers lined up in a row inside his open closet, his Milky Way poster, his basketball signed by Allen Iverson, his old cotton quilt worn to the softness of silk, and picture after picture of a dark-haired girl so glossy and sassy and blithely grinning that she could not possibly be me. I lost my bearings and fell, missing the bed and landing on the rug, completely unhinged. Dev lay down on the floor of his room and held me, clamped on tight and whispered, "Shh, shh, shh," like a mother to a child, until I finally calmed down. A few hours later, when I'd regained the ability to sit up like a normal person and speak in sentences, I begged him not to go away, or at least to go somewhere in the United States, a place with phone service and internet, a place he could fly home from at Christmas and that I could save up and fly out to once or twice, a place without black mamba snakes, dengue fever, unstable governments, and lions. It would take months for me to flush with shame at my stereotypical depiction of Africa, that's how far gone I was. I expected Dev to agree to change his plans, and was stunned when he didn't. He said it was too late to cancel. He said the trip meant a lot to him. He talked about how privileged he was. When he used the phrase giving back, I covered my ears and considered screaming. Which is when he took my face between his two hands, and in the most loving voice I'd ever heard, said this.
We're us, remember? Even when we're apart, we're together. Quantum locality, electron entanglement, remember? We're outside the space-time continuum, Claire, where distance just isn't. Wherever I am, I'm yours. We'll be okay. I'd never leave if I weren't sure about that.
They may have been the sweetest words he'd ever spoken to me. They may have been the sweetest and also nerdiest words anyone had ever, inside or outside the space-time continuum, spoken to anyone. But I didn't care. All I wanted was for him to stay. He left. And I turned into a person I didn't know. Sad. Disorganized. I stopped finishing books. Slept a lot. Got quiet. Lost too much weight. Quit tennis. Played the most half-hearted field hockey in the history of the sport. Stopped going out on weekends with my friends. For the first time in my life, my grades slipped. That they didn't fall to rack and ruin was due to a combination of autopilot studying and sympathetic teachers. I believed what everyone around me believed, that I was in limbo, waiting for Dev to come home so our life together could start back up. But then an odd thing happened. When it came time to apply early action to UVA, I let the deadline pass by. And when I did apply to colleges, without discussing it with anyone or examining my motives, I found myself sending my application there, but also to a lot of other, more far-flung places. Big Midwestern universities, 2 colleges in California. Worried about my lackluster, weirdly un-Claire-like letters and the reports of my decline he'd been getting from his parents and Cornelia, Dev skipped the orphanage, came home early, 3 weeks into April, and drove down to Virginia to see me before he'd even unpacked his bags. Even though I could tell he was shocked by the changes in me, shocked and tender and heartbroken, our reunion was joyful, but when he saw the stack of acceptance letters on my desk, he breathed,
"Oh, wow,"
and looked like he'd just lost his best friend. Still, when I said, "I'm sorry, I don't know why I did that, of course I'm going to UVA," he's the one who said,
"I really want you to, but I think you probably did this for a reason."
So he went to Virginia, and I went to Michigan to figure out how to be a real person without him. Our plan was to stay together, but after 2 months I understood that it wouldn't work. Steady-hearted and ever at home in his own skin, Dev could keep the face, love me outside of space and time, carry me around like a turtle's shell, same as always, but I still didn't know how. So at Thanksgiving break, on the worst day of my life and probably his, I broke it off for good. Eventually, because we couldn't stand not to be, we became best friends, and Dev became a person who sent me perfectly timed, completely inappropriate wedding cake pictures. A person whose mere existence in the world made me happy. So I didn't call Zach after all. I walked downstairs, made coffee, took it outside, sat down on a white Adirondack chair under a blooming catalpa tree, tucked my legs under me, sipped and watched a hummingbird stitch and hover among the columbine, doing some sipping of its own. Relief did not wash over me. I still felt like a low-down, selfish, disgusting scoundrel. But there, in my own backyard, I could envision a time when I might feel slightly less bad, slightly more like the old Claire, deserving of at least a little forgiveness. The sense of almost peace lasted all day. I took a long walk, followed by a short run, weeded the flower beds, played chess on my computer, and, in a breathtaking stroke of luck, found a shoeshine kit in the top of the odds and ends closet and shined every shinable shoe in the house, a task that will forever rank, even if I live to be 100, as one of the most bone-deep, satisfying things I've ever done. After sunset, I walked to a nearby pocket-square-sized public park, lay down on a bench with a sweatshirt tucked beneath my head, and watched tiny bats careen against a sequined sky. Home again, I took a shower, put on my high school gym shorts and my oldest, softest t-shirt, dug up my set of Narnia books, plopped down on the family room sofa, and submersed myself up to my ears in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. I'd just gotten to the chapter where Eustace wakes up to discover he's been turned into a dragon when I heard a car come down the driveway. Or start down the driveway. It pulled in and then stopped, sliding a wedge of headlight light between the not-quite-shut curtains and onto the wall. Gordon and my mother weren't due back until the next morning. Fear zipped through me, and I tried to wish the car back down the driveway and into the night, but the wedge stuck, unwavering, to the wall. 30 seconds later, the back screen door creaked, and someone began to bang out a slow, continuous, doomsday rhythm with what sounded like the heel of his hand.
"Claire! Are you there? Please tell me you're there!"
Zach, either drunk or crying or both.
Thud. 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 Thud.
"Claire! Please, I don't need to come in, just come talk to me!"
Our next-door neighbor's Irish setter, Galway, began barking. Hedwig, the corgi across the street, followed suit. I knew that soon the entire neighborhood would go off like a string of canine firecrackers. "Coming!" I called. And with dread creeping up my spine, I walked into the mudroom, switched on the outside light, and turned the knob. Zach stood on the second step, his elbow propping open the screen door. with his golf cap, t-shirt, and shorts, tear-streaked face, anxious eyes, and shaky smile, he looked like a 14-year-old, here to confess that he'd broken my car window with his baseball. "Oh, Zach," I said, sighing.
"Will you come out and talk to me just for a minute?"
His words slid into one another, blurred at their edges. "God, tell me you didn't drive here."
"No, no, I wouldn't do that."
He jerked his head in the direction of the driveway.
"Ian. He only agreed to it because I threatened to drive myself. He said all we need is for you to get a DUI and bring more shame and ignominy down upon the dignified heads of your family."
"He said that, did he?" Zach waved his hand aimlessly around in the air.
"Something like that. We spent last night at his fancy condo in Baltimore. The natives call it Ballmore, which is pretty appropriate since I've been bawling more these past couple days than I ever have before."
"Ian drove you all the way from Baltimore?"
"He did. You know, you should probably let me in or else you come out and shut the door. Wouldn't want to let bugs into your family abode."
Zach held the screen door open for me and edged away so that I could slip by him. Then he let the door shut. We stood a few feet apart, just at the foot of the stairs. He took off his cap and ran his hand through his hair.
"I feel like I should get down on my knees,"
he said with a limp chuckle.
"Zach, why are you here?"
He smiled bleakly.
"I just needed to check to see if you'd changed your mind yet."
I started to speak, but he reached out and touched a shushing finger to my lips. Reflexively, I jerked my head back like I'd been stung and could have kicked myself afterward.
"And on the off chance that you hadn't changed your mind yet,"
he went on,
"I wanted to ask you to please consider doing it soon, because no one will ever, ever love you like I do."
His voice broke at the word love, and he pressed his golf cap to his eyes, then took it away. My own eyes burned, and I wanted to hug him so badly that I clasped my hands behind my back to stop myself.
"How could I have caused you so much pain?" I whispered. "I'm so sorry."
"Hey, all you have to do to fix it is come back to me. On any terms you want. We can start all over. God, we can date, even. Remember when you took me hiking?"
I swallowed a sob.
"A bee stung you, and it rained."
"I loved it."
Behind my back, my two hands gripped each other for dear life.
"Zach, I can't come back to you."
He reached out and rested his hands against my upper arms. I didn't flinch.
"You don't have to decide now. I just wanted to check and see if maybe you had, but you don't have to until you're good and ready."
"Please, I've decided already."
He froze, and I watched his soft expression clear away like a window defogging. For a split second, his hands began to grip my arms, but then he yanked them off, spun around, and frisbeed his hat into the shadowy yard where it snagged on a rosebush.
"This is why,"
he said, his voice rising.
"This is fucking why!"
I stepped up onto the first step.
"Your perfect house, perfect family. I hate my family because they suck, but I hate yours even more."
I stepped onto the second step and silently slipped my hand through the screen door's handle, my thumb on the button. Zach whirled around, his teeth flashing in a bitter grin.
"Your perfect parents, and Cornelia and Teo, whoever the hell they even are, not even blood relatives, all those people. They're why you think you don't need me, right? Am I right?"
I stood, fear thrumming through me, the yard looking watery and weird, the button under my thumb the only solid and true thing on the entire planet. And then, from deep inside the house next door, on the other side of the row of flame-shaped cypress bushes, Galway began to bark, to send clear, wild sounds flying into the night.
"Shut the hell up, dog!"
spat Zach. Drawing his leg back like a soccer player taking a penalty kick, Zach slammed his foot against the terracotta planter next to the back gate. He probably expected to send it flying, but the planter merely fell over and lay on its side, intact. In the yellow light, I could see a handful of potting soil splash out, but the fern inside didn't budge. In the stillness that followed, Zach stared down at the planter, and I pulled open the door and slipped inside the house.
"The neighbors will be out here any minute," I told him quickly.
You need to leave. Without taking his eyes off the planter, Zack nodded.
Okay. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to do that. We'll talk later.
He swiveled his head to catch my eye.
Okay. Later. Soon.
I didn't speak or move, just regarded him blankly through the screen, then watched as he jogged out of the yard. As I listened to Ian's car pull out fast, tires whining, and blast off through my pretty, sleepy, tree-lined neighborhood, there it was at last. Unmistakable. Ribboning like a cool, bright stream up through my chest, trickling down my legs and arms. Relief.
Chapter 9. Edith. Edith didn't fit. She had not fit before, plenty of times, although she was nearly positive that she had never been regarded as odd, not full-blown odd anyway. Aloof was what she usually got, even occasionally, ridiculously, mysterious. Her sort of look somehow taking the more accurate adjective shy out of contention. Although even shy wasn't quite right. The truth was that Edith had always done her best within a clearly defined context. School. Nursing school. Work. She could talk, could even be funny or clever, when there was something real to talk about. Books, tests, teachers, current events, music, patients, cases. Concepts. Edith could get downright voluble about concepts. Evolutionary theory, communism, fascism, ethics. She could talk to the grocer about vegetables, to the butcher about meat. She had talked to her father about birds, fungi, tides, bees, ants, the phases of the moon, predator and prey, the cycle of life. When she fell in love with Joseph, she discovered, for the first time, her gift for telling a story, for finagling beauty and humor and weirdness out of the everyday with the right detail, the proper metaphor. But coffees, cocktail parties, neighborhood barbecues, all these seemed to her like games, the rules of which she'd never learned. Conversations reminded her of the time when, as a little girl, she tried to catch tadpoles with her fingers, the subject matter darting and slippery, wriggling away at the last second. Her confusion turned her, not fluttery, but blunt, keeping quiet, then tossing a comment like a stone, sending the tadpoles skittering off. In the ungainly silence that followed, the other women would sip their drinks, bite into a canapé or deviled egg, telegraphing, "Poor Joseph, what an odd bird his wife is," to each other with their eyes. But for Joseph's sake, she kept trying. In truth, Edith would have spent her days with only her husband. To her, his body alone was a world, rippling, bristling, full of weather, flavors, seasons, never the same 2 days in a row, and their private sphere of house, yard, marshes, bay, ocean, beach was an entire universe. Both were enough to command her rapt attention, to fire her imagination, to bring her joy for a thousand lifetimes. Honestly, the idea of wanting to spend time with people one did not love absolutely mystified her. But Joseph liked company, small talk, sharing food. Magnetic, gregarious, he drew people to him and was drawn in return. And he wanted her with him. So she went. But she never fit. Even looking like everyone else eluded her. All her life, she had never managed polish or tidiness. Never, even as a child, been perky or pretty or cute. She'd understood, because she had been told, that she was a certain kind of beautiful, with her long, angular face, her strong brows, curving mouth, dark, feathery lashed eyes, but, distracted by books and animal tracks, mud, water, insects and bones, and half in love with loneliness, she had never cared. A gangly girl, now she stood tall, narrow-hipped, broad-shouldered, leggy as a heron. In an era of things staying in place, of starch and hairspray, she was loosely gathered, pieces of her forever apt to ravel, crease, fly away. In the salt air, her long bob uncurled, tangled in wind. Her lipstick smudged. At home, she went without makeup, lived in blue jeans and Joseph's shirts, her hair held off her face with a scarf. In the beginning, when they first fell in love, for the first month perhaps, her beauty mattered to her as it never had before. She loved her face because Joseph did, because it was something she could give him, but it was as if once she had handed it over to him, had given it into his keeping for good, she forgot about it. When he photographed her, he laughed because she never posed, never offered the planes of her cheeks to the light, never even remembered to look into the camera. Instead, she watched him, cherishing each piece of him with her attention, his hands holding the camera, his brown hair falling on his forehead, the shell curve of his ear, the way the collar of his shirt opened to reveal, like a secret, the triangle of skin at the base of his throat.
Chapter 10. Claire. The morning after Zach's nighttime visit, he texted me a long, sad apology that made me ache for him, and that ended,
"I messed up like I messed up at the lake house. It's like I have this well of anger inside me, and I don't know how exactly it got there, and I don't know how to cap it so that nothing gets out. But I think I can learn, especially when it comes to getting angry at you. Because God, Claire, I know you deserve better, and I understand why you'd run away from a person like me. But I still wish you'd stayed. I know you could fix me if you were here."
I texted back, "I messed up too, Zach, so badly. But I really believe you don't need me to change the things you want to change about yourself. You're smart and strong and good enough to do it on your own. I hope I am too." Even as I tapped out the message, I was dogged by the thought that it might not be true. What if Zach did need me? What if I were his only hope? I understood how arrogant that sounded, but the fact was people did need people. People saved each other all the time, every day. What if, in the grand scheme of things, I was supposed to stick around and save Zach? It would have been so easy to text again, to tell him that he was right, that I would get on the first plane back to him. I could envision myself typing the words. It would make him so happy. Imagining his happiness was almost more than I could bear. "If you went back, you could never leave again," I told myself. "It would be too cruel. If you went back, it would be for forever." That forever is what sent me backward, reeling away from the edge I'd been standing on. I realized I would probably go back to that edge more than once. But on that day, I turned off my phone, set it down, and ran up the stairs the way I used to when I was a kid, taking them two at a time, clomping like an elephant. I remembered how back then I hadn't been running away from anything. I had run out of a pure, free-floating urgency, just because if you were going someplace, you might as well get there fast. For the next week, I threw myself into business matters. Zach and I had been all set to move from his spiffy apartment to an even spiffier one, Zach having insisted that no marriage could thrive outside the presence of granite countertops and a very sparkly, nearly noiseless dishwasher, so my belongings were already boxed up and ready to go. The image of those stacked and neatly labeled boxes patiently waiting to be carried into a future that no longer existed was one of many that haunted me in the days following our breakup. But the boxes made Hildy's shipping my stuff to my parents' house easy enough. Easier for me than for Hildy, obviously, who in typical Hildy fashion told me to shut the hell up every time I tried to thank her. I borrowed money from my parents to cover the cost of my half of the apartment security deposit, the moving company's security deposit, and all the other deposits toward a future that had turned out to be the opposite of secure. I wrote a half-charming, half-frantically desperate letter to the graduate speech pathology program in Boston that I'd bailed out of when I'd agreed to marry Zach, asking them to please consider reinstating me, if not this year, then pretty please with sugar on top, the next. I returned wedding gifts and penned endless notes of apology to the givers and to all our would-be-turned-would-not-be wedding guests. And if I say that I felt every word of those notes carve themselves into my skin like in that scary Dolores Umbridge detention scene in the fifth Harry Potter, I'm exaggerating, but only a little. And through it all, each night, I spent hours texting and talking with Zach, whose moods encompassed every permutation of heartbroken, from grieving to enraged, from bitter to sweet to bittersweet, from pleading to threatening, from repentant to accusatory, from hopeful to hopeless, sometimes all in a single conversation. It was brutal, and maybe the hardest part was realizing, like a plunge into ice water, that I loved him, a fact that had gotten lost in all the pre-wedding hubbub of his loving me and in the post-non-wedding hubbub of shattering his heart. True fact. Zack was lovable, and I loved him. I could not marry him, but I loved the complicated, contradictory, sweet, naughty humanity of him. And it is one thing to crush the heart of a man who loves you unrequitedly, and quite another to do it to a man you love back. I cried a lot. I scrolled through old photos on my phone late into the night. At least a dozen times I came one breath away from asking him to take me back. For 3 weeks, I regrouped, introspected, considered my options, although from the outside, and sometimes from the inside too. This process looked a lot like taking long walks, staying up late watching old movies with my mom, and lying on various items of indoor and outdoor furniture, binge-reading the books from my childhood. And then one day, Edith gave me a house. It started with a letter from a Philadelphia law firm, and the letter led to a phone call, to a few more phone calls, to a car trip, to a meeting at a glossy conference table with a robot-like, staccato-voiced, auburn-haired lawyer named Eloisa Dunn, who explained that Edith Herron had died of cancer just 2 weeks after I'd met her at the hotel in Virginia, and had left me a house in a pretty, or so Eloisa Dunn had heard, not being a beach person herself, a fact that did not surprise me, coastal town called Antioch Beach, Delaware. Eloisa Dunn was not authorized to give any other information regarding the deceased, and in fact knew no other information, but explained that the house had been uninhabited for nearly 60 years. However, it was in remarkably good shape since a property maintenance company had cared for it since Edith Herron had moved away in the 1950s. The company was paid through an anonymous trust that had been put in place not long after her exiting the property, and as there was still at least 5 years' worth of money left in the trust, I was obligated neither to live in the house nor to care for it. I need not even go there, although the house was mine to keep or to sell.
"I imagine it would be worth a very tidy sum these days," said Eloisa Dunn. "Anyway, the residence seems to have been a boarding house for a few years, and consequently it has a name. Blue Sky House."
A light dawned. "Say that again," I said.
"Blue Sky House. Not your typical house name, but quaint, I suppose."
"You're his blue sky, when everything else is darkness. But is he yours?" Edith's voice, bell clear and ageless in the morning air.
"I won't sell it," I said, so quickly that my mother gave me a surprised glance, and even Eloisa Dunn's eyes widened briefly and blinked once in her otherwise motionless cameo face.
"Sometimes in order to hold your own, you need a place of your own," I said. "Oh, Edith."
"Claire," said my mother, frown lines between her eyes.
"It's what she said to me. Light and space, all my own. A place to breathe easy. I told her I used to carry my safe place around with me like a turtle, but then when I got involved with Zack, I somehow stopped."
I stared at my mother in wonder.
"So she gave you one,"
my mother said softly.
"An almost total stranger talked you out of your engagement to the wrong man, and then gave you a safe place to go. Unbelievable."
"Yes, it is unbelievable,"
I thought for a moment.
"Or it should be. Somehow, though I didn't expect this at all, and I know it's rare and even sort of crazy, it's somehow believable anyway. Because of Edith. Because of how she was."
"How was she?"
asked my mother. "I don't know. Bigger than the rest of us. Overarching. More part of things than regular people. And more knowing."
"Maybe because she was dying,"
said Eloisa Dunn. I stared at her. With her foggy, faraway eyes and turned inward expression, she suddenly didn't look like a robot at all.
"My mother did that in her last days,"
she went on.
"Became intuitive, as if she'd tapped into some cache of understanding the rest of us couldn't get anywhere near. And she was so peaceful.
I'm sure she didn't actually glow, but in my memories of her, she's glowing.
The three of us sat there, considering whether death's nearness could transform a person, whether it could maybe turn their personal borders watery and permeable so that more of the world got in. Eloisa was the first to snap back to herself. She slid a manila envelope out from under her stack of legal papers, unfastened it with one quick motion, and handed it to me. I looked inside. Keys. A lot of them, each one tagged. I turned the envelope over and spilled the keys onto the conference table, then fanned them out with my hands. Front door. Back door. Cabinet one. Cabinet two. Fireproof box. And so forth.
I wonder,
I said slowly.
What do you wonder? Asked my mother. I smiled.
I'm gonna sound crazy again, and maybe it's just me projecting all of this stuff onto Edith. Probably, that would make sense. But anyway, I feel as if, in addition to giving me the house, she's giving me herself. I think she wants me to discover who she was.
And you wonder if one of these keys? Said my mother.
Exactly. I wonder if one of them will unlock Edith. I hope so. I had exactly 3 encounters with her, none of them long, but I hope so. I hope so, so much.
Chapter 11. Edith. August 1952. It was during what they both knew would be their last canoe trip together that Joseph made her promise to live. And by live, I mean all the way, with all your heart and soul. If there is any of either left, she said. But she canceled out the rueful words with a broad smile because she would not, could not, had sworn not to, since he'd first fallen so ill, give him cause to fear for her. My precious Edie, he said, you must promise to give yourself entirely to someone or something because that's who you are. You are a genius at devoting yourself. It's what makes you happiest. Not to someone, she said firmly, and you may as well not even try to talk me out of that, mister, because you won't, not if you throw every ounce of your charm at me. You are my only someone. I will stay devoted to you and to no one else ever. That's that. He eyed her skeptically. I'm not so sure, but never mind. Something, then. Find something. Of course, the world should cherish you in return, but that will take care of itself. Nothing in the wide world is easier than loving you. Says you, she teased. Joseph laughed, and she could see his features tighten with pain, watched his right hand grope vaguely at his back, felt the canoe move side to side as he shifted his big, newly angular body in search of the comfortable position she knew he wouldn't find. And there it was, the sensation of spinning on a cliff's edge, the tearing, metallic screech of losing him forever gripping the back of her throat. She looked away from her husband, squinted at a bird flying low above the water until she felt the canoe's wobbling cease. She pointed. A shearwater. Not a very elegant bird, really. All that stiff-winged teetering, like a seesaw. Unlike you, my elegant bird, said Joseph, reaching for her hand. She set down her oar and clasped his hand, which had grown thinner, but was somehow still square and strong and familiar. It was she, and not the nurse, but the lover, who had noticed the first symptoms. The faint yellowing of his eye whites and skin. She saw it earliest on the pale places untouched by sun, like a pollen stain on the smooth skin across his hip bones and the tops of his thighs, and a new articulation of his ribs and cheekbones and spine and wrists. Such slight changes, but she had taken his body apart, focusing on one tiny piece of him at a time, and put it back together so often, with her camera and her eyes, and had mapped the intricate, stretched-out landscape of him with her own bones and muscles and nerve endings so many times and with such absorption that she detected what most people would have missed. Still,
It wasn't early enough, not even close. A fact he'd so vehemently forbidden her to torture herself with that she'd complied. Once he began to go down, he went so fast that she began to have dreams of wildfire raging.